You are listening to The Operative Word, a podcast brought to you by the Journal of the American College of Surgeons. I'm Dr. Lillian Erdahl, and throughout this series, Dr. Tom Verghese and I will speak with recently published authors about the motivation behind their latest research and the clinical implications it has for the practicing surgeon. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and not necessarily that of the American College of Surgeons. So hello and welcome back to the Operative Word podcast of the Journal of the American College of Surgeons. I'm Lillian Erdahl, one of your co-hosts, and I'm here today with Dr. Dai Chung, who is a professor of surgery and the chief medical officer for children's health at UT Southwestern. Welcome.
Great. Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Thank you for being here. I do want to ask you, do you have any disclosures to share?
No, I have none.
Okay. Well, we're going to be talking about your research article called Social Determinants of Outcomes Disparity Among Pediatric Solid Tumor Patients. And I hope that you'll start by telling us a little bit about kind of the background, you know, why it's important to look at social determinants and how they might impact patient outcomes.
Yeah, no, I think thanks for that question. I think this is a really important area. I myself have been in a nearly three decades of pediatric cancer biologist studying solid tumor on the bench, as well as translational work in trying to develop novel small molecule but sort of intracellular targeted therapeutics. So it's a tumor of my interest has been neuroblastoma, which happens to be the most common extracranial solid tumor that occurs in children. And despite all the advances and some great, great programs throughout the country, the overall survival remains relatively flat at about 50% median survival at 5-year period. So it's really complex and complicated heterogeneous tumor that we've invested in our laboratory for the past 7 years working on this. So it is sort of, I have surgical residents and fellows come in and do some great work. And what we have sort of found of late as our work, we've been putting more intense and active efforts to translate our laboratory findings is that clearly, especially in the last few years, really a highlight in our, you know, whether it's social settings or in medical, health disparities are real. And I think there's been a lot of great work by our surgical colleagues, as well as medical colleagues, and throughout all different major institutions have done some really fabulous work. And we felt that there had not been as much of focus, I should say, or limelight as shed on there is truly a health disparity exists in pediatric cancer population. I mean, we think of when you talk about cancer, I mean, it's a really challenging area for emotionally, socially, but when you're especially talking about kiddos succumbing to cancer, you know, everyone's heart breaks and we want to do everything possible. So you would think that all the kids get access and get as efficient and great care. But we started to look into data. Let's say we just look at our registry data in the state of Texas and see whether that even a disparity exists. We were really surprised to find the socioeconomic status and the many, many variables do play a role in sort of there's definitely a disparity that exists in delivery and for the patients receiving care. Comprehensive care when it comes to pediatric solid tumor.
I appreciate hearing about your background in, you know, bench research too, because one of the things that you point out is the challenge of translating the bench research to the bedside is not always can we figure out how to take what we've learned and make a drug that's effective and safe to deliver. Sometimes it turns out that the barriers are not ones that you might identify in the lab or you know, within the hospital walls.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think even in my own career, you know, as a basic scientist, you're studying cause and effect, really, testing various, whether it's the drugs or manipulating the genetic modification of cellular makeups. And we're basically, a lot of our laboratory work is trial and error to a degree, using as far as known references and knowledge that we have. So from going from a cellular world to animal, I think that we're a lot better in 2023 and four. So even at the laboratory of small and large animals, where there's some biological differences due to gender of species, we never even questioned those 25 years ago, 30 years ago. Of course, there has to be some bearing. There are different biologies and physiology. So yeah. I think to getting to that point in my own brief sort of career as a cancer biologist have progressed in the right direction. So, but when it comes to truly even translating how a certain targeted therapy might react or act differently in certain kiddos with different ethnicity, biology, I mean, there's a whole host of things that we need to take into consideration. So I think it's an important part of, as a scientist and as a clinician investigator, that we're trying to constantly find better, safer, more effective targeted therapies for kiddos that are coming with cancer. It's an important information for us to be, not only be mindful, but we have to incorporate that into research design. Because unless we do that, we're not going to ever get to the really getting actual meaningful new discoveries.
Yeah, and as a breast cancer surgeon, we look at the research too, especially some of the older research on breast cancer prevention and who was included, and how the trials were designed, and whether the research results really are applicable to all of our patients. So I think, like you said, being mindful about how we design our trials, how we set them up, and then how we apply that at the bedside is important. So you and your team looked at the Texas Cancer Registry. Is that collected from hospitals all over Texas, or how are those data collected? Because I think registry data can be tricky to work with.
Oh yeah, definitely tricky. Yes, it's for all institutions that provide cancer care to kids in the state of Texas. It's voluntary, so it's not necessarily that you can always assume capture all the data, but it's a fairly decent and robust registry that every cancer center in the state of Texas participates. So we felt that it was a good place to start. Given, again, retrospective nature, we needed to start somewhere. We wanted to be able to get some glimpse of the current status as to in the state of Texas. So we were able to identify nearly 4,000 patients, and it's specifics to solid tumors that are extracranial. So then we pared down, as you all know, the most common malignancy in kids is a liquid cancer, as in leukemias and other blood based cancers. So the number of 4,000 we felt was a decent enough of a cohort for us to be able to kind of start looking at and evaluating the question as to, hey, is there outcome difference? Is there access difference in health disparity with regards to these handful of pediatric solid tumor that are extracranial?
And so you looked at a number of different factors. You looked at socioeconomic status. You looked at something called the Area Deprivation Index, as well, which is a new term that I learned. And we're able to identify that there were some factors that could predict worse outcome in these children.
Yeah, no, actually, this is the beauty of being in academics, where our trainees and residents and research fellows, they teach you, I myself wasn't aware of it until she's spending a second year of a time in my lab, and she has her own basic science research projects as well as some translational. And this is sort of conceptually her idea. And she wanted to look at this and presented it to me at ADI. I said, well, what is that? And her name is Dr. Lizzie Cochran, wonderful, our Southwest Center surgical resident who's going to be a pediatric surgeon in the future.
Wonderful.
She explained all of this ADI index that is, we can actually pull a number of key socioeconomic factors, and that she wanted to be able to correlate to patients' clinical outcome in this patient cohort. So I thought, wow, that's a start. And then we started doing some reference checks. some of the other adult cancer centers have used this metric as a measure and sort of a surrogate for socioeconomic factors that might influence patients' outcomes. So it was actually really good that she thought of this, and I was excited for this project.
Yeah, so I was looking too at the registry, and I think the breakdown of patients was interesting. You had about half the patients were male, just slightly over half, and you had represented, I think, a number of different racialized groups, white, Black, and Hispanic, and Asian, and then there was something called other rare minority groups. But when we look at the numbers of those 4,000, the percents, vary quite a bit. So 13.3% Black, 36.2% Hispanic, 1.7% Asian, and 1.8% of these other rare groups. And then 47% were reported as white. And I presume, but I don't practice in Texas, that that's a pretty good representation of the makeup of Texas. But I wonder, even just what we're capturing in the cancer registry, are we getting representative data of the different groups?
Yeah, I think that's a very excellent question. I think a lot of this data registry, we have to also be mindful that they come from large part major big institution academic centers. So it isn't exact representation of the entire state of Texas. So mm-hmm. We have to take it with a grain of salt. But we felt that it gave us enough of a view to start probing these questions. And I think that some of the questions they proposed, whether ethnicity difference and outcome, whether geography based on whether their proximity to near Texas border, because that is a reality in our state. There's southern parts of the state closer to the border are certainly not as urban, developed, mm-hmm. have availability of the tertiary quaternary care. So I think that, again, we wanted to ask a question, is there any correlations to how remotely they live from the urban settings and their access to care, and ultimately whether there's any delay or not, and ultimately the outcome of the patients. So that allowed us to kind of probe various types using a data set, as well as the area deprivation index.
Yeah, and so you found that, which again, I of course, makes sense to me, but looking at that border county resident status was an interesting way, again, I think, to look at disparity. And you found that that was a factor that affected worse outcomes.
Yeah. And, some assumptions and hypotheses, obviously, we kind of use common sense to think that, yeah, I'm sure it has a bearing. So, but I think at the end of the day, a study like this, using some statistical population-based type of studies to validate, and having our assumption to kind of, sure, granted it's a retrospective analysis, it was actually nice for us to be able to demonstrate that, yeah, more away from urban settings and certainly close to Texas southern border, there is correlation as to delayed treatment or delayed access to care and ultimately outcomes. So I thought it was an important findings that we're able to shed from this registry data study.
Well, and I think, the other thing that I didn't say out loud is that, the metric you're looking at is increased risk of death, which is, as you stated earlier, so important to you in the care of children, that if we can save children's lives, that's the focus of what you do. And in addition to residents in a border county being identified as Black race or rare minority race was associated with an increased risk of death. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about, the impact of race or your thoughts on that finding?
Yeah, I think it's a sort of a sad, but the truth, truthfully, the reality is that there is health disparity in our country, and even to pediatric patients with cancer. And I realize in your specialty in breast cancer, there's wealth of published work in that regard as well. And this paper just really reminds all of us and highlights that we have to actively go out of our ways to Be, again, not only mindful, but what can we do to create access, create programs and offerings to these patients that do not have available resources and do not have the accessibility. It is really our responsibility as physicians and surgeons, and have the privilege of being in great academic institutions, and whether it's Iowa City or Dallas, and it's us that we have to think of ways to bring care closer or make it so readily accessible so that patients from remote areas can get equally, if not even better, care for the all the sufferings and conditions that they're having to manage.
Yeah. Well, and thank you for saying that, because I do think it's on all of us. And also it's on our systems. And of course, we're the ones who inform the systems and can advocate for patients within the system. And one of the things that I'm, looked at as well is that you talked about this area deprivation index. And it sounds like even when we take away the ADI, that race is still a factor. So again, there's some part about providing better access, and then there's some part about the systemic barriers or the systemic racism that sort of supersedes that.
I think that was certainly not what I had thought that would be one of the findings. That was very much of a surprise. That, as you said, patients from even low deprivation index area, meaning well, median income and all the socioeconomic factors that you would think, maybe perhaps down the street from you, it's still certain ethnicities and other factors influence to their not having as good of outcome. That really kind of told me, and Dr. Cochran, again, this is a wonderful surgical resident, but that there must be some implicit bias that plays. And it's really important, as we're far better as a practitioner in surgery, providing care and addressing this health disparity. There's still a lot more work ahead of us. And we have to be intentional about it, because it doesn't happen, or it picks itself.
Yeah. And I brought to mind sort of stories that I hear or experts that I read about. Serena Williams actually talked about her experience in pregnancy and sort of being dismissed when she said, feels like I'm having another pulmonary embolism. And I don't have any article in front of me that I can read the exact story, but, that story really stood out to me as an example that even when you're Serena Williams, it can be hard to advocate for yourself. And I was so grateful that someone with a platform would have the vulnerability to share her story about not sort of being listened to in the healthcare setting, because it does tell all of us that, there's still work for us to do.
Absolutely. No, I recall that. And again, it's a sort of real some reminder that the health disparity is real. And as much as a lot of great work had taken place, we're nowhere close to reaching what we should be able to provide and offer to the society. As the most advanced medical community in the world, we can do more.
Yeah. Well, and I would love to hear from you, your thoughts on that. Sort of where do we take these conclusions next? I know you talked a little bit in the publication about, next steps for research. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think we're actually using findings from our study, approaching our system or hospital to figure out what outreach program, what interventions, what offerings that we can actually bring closer to homes in the remote areas to actually truly make an impact. Again, being a realist, even all the sort of great next steps of actionable items, realize this is not going to be addressed overnight. But I think that every little, a new initiatives or program that we can offer is a building blocks to perhaps in a few years from now, we hope to not see any disparities when we're able to reanalyze the data. So specifically, what we want to do is what we are trying to do is using clinical care coordinators to providing sort of a concierge type of a service to families who don't have access to internet. They can't even check their medical record readily. We talk about EMRs and advances in the 21st centuries, but we have to be real. A lot of these folks don't have means. That some of them don't even have cell phones. So we have to, again, design programs and have offerings to paying attention to their level of resource or scarce resources. They don't have much the same as neighborhoods in the urban cities. So clinical care coordinator, outreach program, education, making it easy or having scheduled for patients. And someone with multiple conditions, i.e. when we operate on these patients, often they're needing to come to multiple clinics, surgery clinics, radiation oncologists, social service. Make it easy for them to show up so that we can have all of those offerings and visits in one settings and not asking them, especially in the state of Texas, as large as we are. Some of them are coming from several hours away. I think those are little, each individual things will add up to hopefully we are making some dent to health disparity.
That makes sense to me, providing more support and coordination. And, you know, I'm reminded of patients who, as you said, didn't have cell phones or their phone numbers changed. Maybe they don't have, secure housing. And so you're trying to coordinate complex medical care for a pediatric tumor, you know, when you are worried about sort of basic necessities, sounds overwhelming. To me, you know, thinking in the shoes of our patients. And I think that while we're still struggling quite a bit from our institutions, the recognition that when there are differential barriers, we need to provide additional support is really important. You know, there may be people who have the means to travel or who live down the street from the hospital, but maybe they live down the street from the hospital and, you know, can't get out of work. So again, looking at all of the things that our patients are dealing with outside of the medical care that we can at least potentially have an impact on, as well as those things, like you said, within our control, can we coordinate appointments to be on the same day, or can we help with lodging in some way to help if you have to stay in town from traveling? And, you know, we have here certainly lots of volunteer organizations. We have a Hope Lodge, you know, from the American Cancer Society, but, you know, continuing to figure out how to provide support is going to hopefully make an impact. And I think you mentioned also, you know, how can we tackle implicit bias, you know, with potentially education of our providers and empowering our patients to speak up and call us out when, you know, they feel that we're not listening to them or not understanding what they're going through.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, we hold each other, colleagues, accountable. And again, there has to be intentional effort. This, you know, our disparity problem or issue, it won't fix itself. You know, we have to lead and we have to make an intentional change, actionable items, initiative. Then it'll all amount to our, hopefully in very near future, we won't even have papers like this to be published.
Yes. No, and I just want to say, you know, thank you to you and Dr. Cochran and your colleagues, because, you know, we do need the data so that we can see exactly where the disparities exist. And sometimes also to convince our colleagues or the system that they do exist. You know, so I appreciate you doing this work and showing, you know, that this work can be done, that we can take the wonderful work that's done by people collecting data in registries and talk about these disheartening realities, but then start to change them.
Yep. No, we keep forging on. So yeah. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss our, you know, paper and share some of our thoughts.
Thank you for listening to the Journal of the American College of Surgeons Operative Word Podcast.
If you enjoyed today's episode, spread the word on social media by using the hashtag JacksOperativeWord. Subscribe to The Operative Word wherever podcasts are available, or listen on the American College of Surgeons website at facs.org/podcast.